the other essential story in there is that people think Portlanders, that somehow we just woke up here in Portland and there were thousands of people riding bikes everywhere. It just happened. It was like a miracle, right? Just bikes popped out of the sky and people drank those funny microbrews and they started.
Well, that's my guest today. That's Mia Burke. She's the author of Joyride, Pedaling Toward a Healthier Planet. Mia, she's an author, yes, but so much more. She's former bicycle coordinator for the city of Portland. A couple of decades ago, she was there when great things happened in terms of rethinking mobility options for a built-out city. That's my guest, Mia Burke. And you're listening to CDM Cyclist, and I'm your host, Frank Peters. Thanks for joining me once again. And if you've clicked on over from coronadelmartoday.com, thanks very much, and welcome back again. These audio podcasts, I enjoy them. In my travels, I enjoy seeking out some of the national experts in the whole bicycle advocacy community. And I was in Portland just a few weeks ago, and Jeff Mapes, author of Pedaling Revolution, you've probably listened to his interview here as well, he helped me get introduced to Mia. So that's what we're going to talk about today. But first, let me say thank you to my sponsor. That would be BikeTiresDirect.com. Bike tires, yes, but so much more. Apparel, equipment, everything you need to equip your bike safely and cost-effectively. BikeTiresDirect.com. Well, Mia, we're going to talk a lot today about resistance to change. How do you influence all the different people within city government, the planners, the politicians, everybody involved, the police, as well as the citizens, all the vested interests, to cause great change to occur? Today, Portland, a platinum city, it's also known as the Rose City. Well,
I am Mia Burke.
Let's listen.
President of Alta Planning and Design.
Yeah. What's your short list of roles, Mia?
That's right. Life is short, so I've got to have a lot of hats. Mom to two kids. Hey, president of Alta Planning and Design here. Also, a co-owner of a sister company that's called Alta Bicycle Share, Inc. And we operate bike sharing systems in a number of cities, Washington, D.C., and Melbourne, Australia, and Boston, we're about to launch.
Oh, no kidding. Wow, that's a... Now, is the bike share kind of new? Is that a new venture?
It's new for American cities, and they have had bike sharing programs, much more sophisticated versions in Europe for longer. Then before that, there were unsophisticated, what they call sort of, you know, version one and two in some American cities, including Portland, and then some European cities. But right now, there's this move in American cities to come to the same place that they are in European cities of having these very sophisticated, it's like individualized transit systems, point-to-point transit systems for short trips that you would take on bicycle, very sophisticated operations. And
that's a good way to put it, too. Now, do they GPS track every bike, or can you tell where they are?
The newer generation, they do have GPS units. First, in D.C., we don't have GPS on the bikes, but we can tell where every station that they came from and to, because they're all coded, so we know which bikes are in which stations. The Boston version will have GPS on every bike, so we'll know exactly where people are going.
Who are you dealing with in Boston?
It's the city of Boston and a number of sponsors that are pulling it together.
My friend Nicole Friedman, part of that group?
Yes, Nicole Friedman, exactly. Nicole is one of the brilliant minds behind the whole operation, everything they're doing in Boston. Incredibly energetic person.
She was my first bicycle interview.
Oh, she's fabulous, yes.
I know, I started out right at the top, huh?
Yeah, exactly, right, exactly. Start at the top level of energy and work your way down to the rest of us. No, she's great. She's a really cool person.
Now, Mia, I wanted to interview you in part because you've got a book. How long has the book been out?
It's been out since the fall of 2010. No, it's actually just been out for less than a year, and it's been quite an adventure.
I'll have, jacket on the website. The name of the book?
It's Joyride, Pedaling Toward a Healthier Planet.
And it chronicles, is it 2 decades of your work as an advocate?
It's essentially set up as a memoir, as a tool for taking readers from one place to another place, lineally in time. That's really, I'm using my own career as a way to build the story of transforming communities and opening hearts and minds to bicycle transportation. Because my own journey is, growing up in Car Culture USA in Dallas, Texas, a very chubby youth, a sedentary lifestyle, and then having my own eyes opened and blossoming to the awareness of bicycle transportation as a personal tool for health and fitness and strength and empowerment, and then launching into that as a career. And that has been, my entire career since I was 22 years old. So, yeah, it's the entire career.
Now, you use the word memoir, and as I was trying to put, it's human nature, right? Trying to put the book in a box, I wasn't sure just what box it belonged. But memoir, what does memoir imply? You've got many personal comments in the book, too.
Well, no, I think you're right. I had a hard time putting it in a box, and publishers have a hard time with books that aren't in a box, right? Because it's not... I didn't want it to be a technical tome, okay? First draft was kind of like a technical textbook on how you, what are all the micro details of streets and models and methodologies and policies and programs, and which is what I do in my work. But that's not the book I wanted to write. I wanted it to be representative of the lectures that I give. My other hat is I'm a professor at Portland State University. And in 2001, I started teaching bicycle and pedestrian issues in urban planning to students. And my lectures were technical lectures on planning and infrastructure models and all that stuff. But the way that I would tell them was I naturally gravitated to stories about the challenges we faced when we started getting the ball rolling in Portland in the 90s. All the various things that we had to affect in city government, from the individuals with kind of closed minds or habits that they had been used to, ways that they had been used to dealing with their jobs, which was to move cars safely, move them and keep them from crashing into each other. And now we are asking all the humans, from the maintenance bureau to the parking folks to the policy leaders to the engineers to the planners, and then also the individuals in Portland, the users of transportation. We're asking them all to change their way of thinking about transportation and urban form, and it was a big ask. Yes. And we struggled through it, right? And we continue to struggle through it, honestly, in all the work that I do. And as I was telling these stories to my students, what I was hearing from them is that's what they were inspired by. They came to me afterwards because I hired many of them here at Alta. And they came, they said, what touched me were the stories, the battles, the drama, the media stuff, the up and down nature of every project, how you got to where you got on these projects. Some of them were successes, some of them were failures, but we learned from all those things. And so that's where I thought, okay, I want to share information that's detailed about transportation, but I don't want to bore people. I don't want to be a technical, boring, blah book. I would like to write stories, but I don't want it to be so light that it's just fluff. I want something in between. My personal story, people resonate with personal stories, an overweight person getting more fit, or a person with a closed mind getting more enlightened, or a person with an interesting career. And over again, people are constantly asking me, how, what? You do what? You're in bicycle transportation? What kind of a career is that? Like, there was such a bafflement. And I had gotten these questions so many millions of times that I decided, well, okay, we put together the stories, we weave in a little light technical, not super technical, and we frame it as a lineal memoir following my career, but using my career as more of a metaphor for the transformation of Portland, then the continuing eye-opening transformation of all kinds of American cities and North American cities, and not just the communities, but the individuals. So there is a lot in there, and it is hard to categorize because it's health and it's environment and it's transportation, it's livability, it's sustainability, advocacy, it's traffic modeling. I mean, how do you even put traffic modeling in the same category as, you know, planning big events like a big, you know, car-free event? You know, there, it's hard to put all of that into one book and make it compelling. So it was obviously like, you know, it's hard work, you know, this is hard work. And got myself a really good partner to work on it with me, Joe Kermaski, who's also known as the Metal Cowboy. And he's a really funny writer, writes about bike touring, short chapters, really to the point, punchy kind of writing. And he helped me take all this technical stuff, turn it into compelling, like punchy stories, but then keep an overarching narrative and story arc to keep you, the reader, with me. You know, you start with me. I want you to end with me. I don't want you to kind of pick it up after a couple chapters and go, okay, yawn. Bikes are good. Got it. Or,
and it's got a happy ending, too.
It's got a happy ending. It's, you know, in a way, it's not an ending, right? It's just a beginning of kind of the eye-opening. Like I say, we've only scratched the surface of what we can become in American cities. Portland started earlier than many cities. We have been at it since, you know, really the 70s. Me personally came into it in the early 90s, and still I'm involved in Portland. All these other cities are somewhere either, you know, a little behind or a lot behind, but all of them are getting started in many, many ways. And it's exciting to be at the forefront of having so many communities that are just opening their eyes and getting the ball rolling.
And they listen to you better than, I'm just guessing now, than people did in your hometown here.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. Yeah, it is. It's kind of fun. There's moments where I'm in a city and they, let's face it, okay, we're still a small group. People who ride bikes for daily transportation. If you open up the bigger lens, there's you know, literally millions of people that ride bikes for recreation or sport. But the subset, or the, even maybe it's not even overlapping group that gets on their bike and just goes where they need to go without putting on Lycra or clicky shoes, without, you know, heading out for a long, long ride with sport and fitness in mind, that's a fairly small group. So it is exciting to go to these cities and have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people show up for my events. You know, reading the book as a book club in some cases, you know, they're resonating with the stories and the, you know, the story that, the other essential story in there is that people think Portlanders, that somehow we just woke up here in Portland and there were thousands of people riding bikes everywhere. It just happened. It was like a miracle, right? Just bikes popped out of the sky and people drank those funny microbrews and they started biking.
It's natural to think that. I mean, when you look at the, you know, it's not an end result, but this point in time, it does look like it must have been easy. And you tell the story showing that you had a lot of hard work to do.
Yeah, and I learned when I started working in Portland in the 90s that I went over to Europe and I went, you know, when you go to Copenhagen or Amsterdam, you have that same sensation. Wow, people ride bikes here. It's just amazing. They just do. And then you go talk to the planners and the engineers and they tell a different story. They talk about how although they had more significant populations of people riding bikes pre-World War I, it was post-World War II, the car era came in full force to these very dense urban environments, and that they had to make a very conscious choice to steer themselves in a different direction because the impact of the air pollution and the traffic on safety and mobility and the environment and the economy was so significant that they had to make a conscious choice to go in a different direction. And they did it differently than we're doing it because they rely heavily on pricing, not just on putting in really good bikeways, which they do, but they also make it really expensive to drive, which we don't do. But when I
almost like 100% tax on owning a car.
Yeah, it's very high. Yeah. And the gas prices are expensive and registration fees are expensive and it's expensive to park and there's car free zones. I mean, so a lot of things, right? And so I learned that story. I heard it not just in one city, but I went to 18 cities in 1996.
What a junket. How did you? I mean, that took some funding to underwrite that.
I got a fellowship from the German Marshall Fund. That funded a month-long research tour of 18 cities. And the city of Portland supported me taking the time, but they didn't have to put a dime into it because it was all funded by the German Marshall Fund. So I got very, very lucky.
Crash course, huh? 18 cities in 1 month?
I had a folding bike, a Bike Friday, And I would bike, you know, I'd get off a train, meet with a city staff person, go on a tour, spend the day asking questions, and then get on another train and go to the next city for, you know, the whole month. I know, not a bad junket at all. And it was fabulous. It was just mind-blowing. It really was. And I came back from that, with that story in my head that 18 cities all had the same story, that they were making conscious choices to put in bikeways, to swap off space for motor vehicles for bicycles, to clamp down on the amount of free parking, to make car-free zones, or not always car-free, but car-light zones, to reduce motorist speed in residential areas, to promote bicycle transportation. They all had that same story, although on a different time continuum and in different settings. But it was so compelling to me that I came back really with a very clear picture in my head of what Portland could become, and the fact that it had to be an extremely comprehensive approach, that it wasn't going to work if it was just, you know, one crazy biking chick in the city, like, you know, yakking about bikes, that it had to be a really broad spectrum of advocates and business leaders and city leaders and politicians and traffic engineers and outreach specialists, community members. We had to all be on board. And so I really felt that my background as an international my degree was in international relations, and that degree was all of a sudden really becoming clear why I got it, because it was about relations. It's about finding ways to open hearts and minds and speak to people in their languages. Traffic engineering language is not the same as, you know, citizen A who drives everywhere language. There's a lot of different languages that we all speak, a lot of different filters we all use.
So Portland does. Today, it's a platinum city. It looks like it's got everything working the way any bicycle advocate would want it. But in the book, you tell great stories. I found them really, like, encouraging to hear of the resistance to change that you had to deal with, and then knowing, you know, how things turned out years later. I found that encouraging. Do other people share that too?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's kind of the central message of the book, is change is hard. Backlash is normal, because changing built infrastructure and deeply ingrained habits, it's really hard stuff. So much of the resistance to bicycle transportation isn't really about bicycles. It's just resistant to change. You know, we have what we have. We know how we get around. What we have today, you know, from many people's perspectives, it is what it is. Why do you want to change it? There's been so many wonderful emails I've gotten from people who've read the book who are in positions in city government along the lines of, thank God you wrote this, because this is my experience. So there's a soothingness. It's like a balm for people who are like, I came in here with this high hope that I could just, you know, put in bike lanes and everybody would start biking. And I'm like, ran smack into resistance from, you know, XYZ, long list of camps of resistance and challenges and issues. And so they've read it and gone, oh, okay. And the end result is Portland is what it is. We fought really hard to get as far as we have gotten, and we've made a lot of progress. We still have a long way to go, but it is a city where many people can and do choose, you know, thousands of people can and do choose to get around by bike regularly. And that is an inspiration, right? People get inspired by Portland. So if they know that, hey, it wasn't all rosy. I mean, we just didn't like wake up one morning and everybody was biking. No, we had to fight through the same stuff you're fighting through. That's what's really inspiring for people on many, many levels. And then anybody that's involved in social change, whatever it is, it doesn't even have to be. I have one friend who read it and went, oh, this. Well, you might know Jeff Mapes, who wrote Pedaling Revolution. You interviewed him, right? He goes,
that's how we met.
That's right. He said, he read the book. I gave him an advance copy because he helped kind of inspire me to write it, you know, and he's such a good writer. And I thought he could give me some tips and help me shape out the rough edges. But he read the draft and he went, this is, you could substitute clean water. You could substitute, you know, a long laundry list of things, civil rights, women's rights, you know, things that we're trying to change. And I would hesitate to compare this to any other thing, but I think that the concept that change is messy and it's hard, and evolution of our ways of thinking are really hard, is that's his message, is, you know, persistence and all kinds of different strategies. And, you know, whenever you get pushed against the wall, you're trying to come up with a way around it, over it, under it, you know, through it. all the humans and the messiness of it, the media, the role of the media, you know, all of it. He just said it struck him that it wasn't just about the bike. And then I would have co-opted Lance's title. I even thought about that. It's not about the bike, but I don't want to co-opt Lance's title. That's his title.
Well, that does put it in a nice context. It makes me think I want to share with you. I was a chairman of the co-ed dorm committee in college. So I was a change advocate
for a long time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I suppose that's one of the things I like about bicycling is it does involve change. You've got a lot of great stories in the book, and there's one. You go out to a group of residents somewhere, and you're talking about like slowing down traffic and making it safer for cyclists to go through this neighborhood. And I remember there's a story of a woman, a mother, who complains about cars zipping through the neighborhood and making it unsafe for her kids just to play in the neighborhood. You remember that?
Yeah. This story was about a fairly busy road where it's a really critical missing gap in the bikeway network because it goes over a bridge and there's not that many, like an overpass over the highway, and there's very few. This is basically it. You got to get over this overpass or you can't ride your bike in this neighborhood. And there's a pretty significant trade-off that we were talking about, which was trading off parking on one side of the street for two bike lanes. And so her very emotional reaction was that the parked cars in front of her house prevent her kids from running into the street, that they act as a barrier. Now, the street is already it's a pretty busy street. So it's not like a street where kids are actually playing in the street. And she was very emotional about this. And then there was a police officer next to her who had an issue of having to park. They all had off-street parking, but they used the on-street parking as well for, in the case of the police officer, they had multiple people living in the house, so they had to shuffle cars around. And then there was a guy who just was opposed to it, period, on principle. And he organized all his family from different parts of the region to come to city council and testify, which actually really hurt because they weren't residents of the street. They were just his relatives and they all had the same name. And then there was a young fellow who came to city council and complained bitterly about losing the parking because he's going to have to cross the street to get into his car to drive like a block to the 7-Eleven. And that really hurt the concept as well. It was like, you can't walk a block. And we're not talking about a big street. I mean, depending on who listens to this, this is a street that just has one lane of parking on each side and one lane in each direction. So it's 36 feet curb to curb, which isn't a very wide street. So having to cross the street is not a significantly challenging thing to do. But I think that story is reflective of something that we need to all be aware of, which is there are trade-offs, and this was an impact on these people. And I had to really learn that. Like, I am an advocate, but I'm also a professional trying to get us to a better place. So I'm not just coming in here to steamroll. I'm trying to find a solution. I would prefer not to have to impact the parking in front of their houses, but there are trade-offs, and there's a real question that we face in urban areas all the time, which is what is the highest and best use of public space? And that space in front of your house is owned by the public. It's not your personal parking space. That traffic lane is not your personal traffic lane. That sidewalk is not even your personal sidewalk. It's owned by the public. And we, the public, have to grapple with, well, maybe on-street parking is more important in certain areas, particularly in a business district with no off-street parking. But maybe in an area where everybody has off-street parking, very large driveways, and there's plenty of parking all around, and we're trading off, you know, 10 spaces to get in a really critical missing link, maybe the trade-off is in favor of the bicycle transportation. Maybe it's more valuable to move people and goods by bike and by car than it is to store vehicles on public property. And that's, you know, if you go to the European cities, they've made a very clear decision that storage of personal private vehicles is not a function for the government to handle for everyone, that people have to store their vehicles off-site, and maybe they have to get smaller vehicles because they can't have three. Or maybe they have smaller and lesser and fewer than everybody getting to store three or four SUVs, which they won't put in their garages because that's where they store all their tools and their bikes. But they will, and their lawnmower, but they will, and they won't store them in the driveway because that's where the basketball hoop is, but they will store them on the parking in front, on the space in front on the street. And when the government comes and says, well, we're kind of thinking that it might be better to use that space for what could be curb extension to narrow the pedestrian crossing distance. It could be bike lanes. It could be a bioswale to drain the water that's runoff from the stormwater system. It could be a park. It could be, you know, street trees or other kinds of greenery.
Curbside dining.
Curbside dining, exactly. There's a lot of different things that we might want to use public space for, and we get to grapple with that in our work every day. And, you know, the more and more I grow in my understanding of urban form and function, the more I'm convinced that we haven't made very good choices in the past, and we have a lot of evolution to get to in our you know, and these are hard choices. And what I continue to learn, I said all throughout the book, is we have a lot of resistance to this change, and then the change happens, and it almost always, like almost always, turns out to be the right choice to choose in favor of humans and human mobility and environmentally and sustainable choices. Those are almost always the right choices. The sky does not fall. You know, it's not like massive gridlock ensues or people start crashing into each other or our property values drop because we lost a couple parking spaces, or the businesses go out of business because maybe they traded off a car parking space for bike parking. You know, none of those things that are our fears tend to be realized in reality. And it's the opposite. Our greatest delights are realized when we make those hard choices.
And you have a graph in the book here that it shows it's way towards the end.
You're almost there.
Yeah. But would you describe that graph?
Yeah, because this is a happy story. This one for the next book as well. I'm going to make it two graphs. A little bit too much on one graph, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I kind of tried to cram too much on one graph. It's a little complicated, right?
But it's a good story.
Okay, so the story is, as we've built out the bikeway network in Portland, which shows the bars are the number of bikeway miles. So we went from having less than, you know, around 50 to 60 when I first started at the city. And that bikeway mileage was primarily an off-street path wiggling through a park. So it wasn't really about bicycle transportation, although it is an amazing trail. We started adding bikeways in the city. So some of them are bike lanes. Some of them are off-street paths that are more urban. Some of them are on-street bicycle boulevards in neighborhoods, traffic-calmed streets. Put it all together, we've grown to about 300 miles of bikeways. As we've built out the bikeway network, bike use has increased in lockstep with that increase in the bikeway network. It's gone from about 2,000 or almost 3,000 bicycle trips per day on the four of the downtown bridges to today almost 18,000 bicycle trips per day on those same four bridges, which is phenomenal growth and you know, exponential growth. This next part of the story is that as bicycle use has gone up, the bicycle motor vehicle crash rate has plummeted. The overall number of bicycle motor vehicle crashes has remained fairly steady, but because of the increased bicycle use, the crash rate has plummeted. And that story has been mirrored in New York and San Francisco and Seattle and all the European cities. And we theorized that as we built out the network, we planned for it. We wrote it into our bike plan. This was what we had hoped would happen, but it was somewhat of a hope at the time that we did it in the 90s, like a theory or like a social engineering experiment. If we do this, will the trends that happened in Europe be replicated? We sure hoped so. My friend Earl Blumenauer, who's a congressman, has said, you got to stop talking about this social experiment because we've proven it. The social experiment part's over. The more people,
it's not a theory; it's a law
anymore. It's proven. You know, we put in what we put in. More people started biking; the crash rate went down. And there's some other interesting facets to the graph. One is that in the period of about 2002, the bike use the line shoots way up into the sky. It grows faster than the growth in the bikeway network. So why is that? What's the story there? And the story is, in the 90s, we put in a lot of bikeways. In the zeros, after I left the city of Portland, there was less mileage added, but there were some really critical missing pieces added, like bridge connections and a wonderful trail in downtown Portland. So some really critical small mileage pieces, but very high value pieces. So that's part of why the growth kept going. And then around 2002, 2003, the city of Portland started an outreach program that's called Smart Trips. And it is a program that targets individuals one-on-one to hold their hands with information and encouragement activities to allow them to incorporate bicycling into their lives, to really meaningfully encourage people to find a way to start. So it might not be the work trip or long trips, or it might just be the trip to the grocery store on the weekend. You know, however people resonate and can resonate, that's where they help people get to. And from there, the bike usage soars into the sky and has kept going at this exponential rate.
That one graph.
All of that, I know. I need to change the graphics too.
Well, but
I think
still,
it needs to be a whole page.
Oh, I think so.
Explanation.
Because it's an advocate's,
it's a
you know,
tool. Right. It's
tool.
A dream, right?
Yeah, a dream. Yeah, it's a dream. It's almost unbelievable to go into, let's say, take my neighborhood where we're, you know, have a lot of work to do still, mm-hmm. to take that into a group of citizens and show that to them. There'd be some degree of disbelief.
You know, and that's a great point because I think you have to recognize a couple of things with this. First of all, people always ask me the next question. I'll be in a room and I'll show this chart and the engineer in the room will go, where'd you get this data? Did you guys just make it up? And there have been people that have said, you guys just, what did you just get out there? You like count one person? And I mean, how do you come up with this? So I just want to be clear that, and I'll probably add this into the next edition too. The city of Portland has been very thorough and dedicated to data collection. So we're really like the geek's best friend. And so since the early 90s, we've had people out counting bicyclists on the four bridges in the same spot using the same exact methodology every year. We've got counts not just on those four bridges, but in dozens of locations all over the city. We've partnered with classes at Portland State University. We've got trained volunteers. We've also got staff that are trained. We have four different methods that we've used to track bicycle use. There's a census, a variation on the theme that the census does. There's a survey that the city does where it asks residents how they get around. There's the bike counts. And then there's also the Smart Trip surveys that they specifically do before and after they do this kind of encouragement program. So all of these show the same trend, just kind of at different, they're all different scales, but they show the same trend. So we're very confident that this data is solid and that the trends are absolutely solid. The investment pays off. And I should point out what I don't have on the chart, but another chart that would be really useful is that all of this was done for it's basically about 1% of the city's capital budget for transportation, a little less than 1%. And if you rebuilt everything that we've built today, all the bike lanes and the trails and the bike boulevards and the bike parking and the encouragement programs, it would cost about $60 million. And that sounds like a lot of money. But when you put it in context, that amount would buy you about 1 mile of urban freeway, or like a fifth of an interchange, or maybe half of a study for a new bridge. I mean, it's you put it in context.
Wow, that's something.
Kind of a bang for it's kind of a good deal. Plus, you get all these other benefits. We've got we've got some pretty good data and evidence on the health side, the environmental side, the congestion side. We've also got some the growth of an industry. We've actually grown an industry that's about $100 million worth of bike-related activity and 1,500 jobs. People like jobs in this economy, right? So it's a good story on the jobs side of things. And the traffic engineers have gone, many of them, some of them have been great leaders, but some of them were very dubious. And it makes sense. Of course they're dubious. This is what I just want to resonate over and over again. Of course people are dubious. Of course they're resistant to change. This is outside of like most people's way of thinking. They drive every day. How can they possibly envision themselves comfortably zipping along in a skirt and high-heeled boots on a road that has no bike lanes? It's not, you know, so we have to recognize where people are at. And traffic engineers are mostly trained in moving cars and trying to keep them from crashing into each other. That's what they've been trained in. That's what they've been doing. So if we're asking them to do something else, it's not going to happen overnight. We're going to have lots of work to get them there. And so in the beginning, in the 90s in Portland, there was a lot of resistance from many of the traffic engineers. Not all of them. Again, some of them. In fact, my friend Rob Birchfield, who's a city traffic engineer, really got it. And we could not have done it without him. He's a great leader. But many of his staff were like, yeah, and there's a lot of resistance, right? And But they've come around to going, wait a second, if we look at those, the data, we're data-driven. If we look at the data and we go, what, 17,000 daily trips on those bridges, look at the increase in capacity, motor vehicle traffic on the bridges has remained flat. But population has increased. The number of jobs and humans living in the area has increased. Traffic overall has increased 20% on those bridges, but it's all bike traffic. We haven't had to add any capacity for motor vehicles. And so the traffic engineers have come around to going, we've seen the data. It's taken 15 to almost 20 years to get to this point, but we get it now. This is good from a traffic standpoint. And so there's not, the resistance is still, there's still resistance. I mean, there is still resistance because these trade-offs are hard, particularly when you're making trade-offs with built infrastructure, you know, in already built cities. I mean, if we were going to start from scratch, that'd be a whole nother thing, but we have to deal with what we've got. So there are trade-offs and it can be very challenging. But I don't think that there's, we've certainly made it to the point where the resistance is more sophisticated.
Now, the bridges, it makes me think, are wonderful for they're like choke points to monitor traffic. Yeah. They're ideal.
Yeah, exactly. It's a good way to do it. And lots of cities do it that way for traffic as well. For motor vehicle traffic, bike traffic, you kind of take bridges. Now, other cities may not have Portland's layout, and they don't, where where so many people take these core bridges to get to this area. So it's an advantage, but lots of cities do some variation on what they call a cordon count, where you count all the entry points into and out of a downtown area, for example. And Portland does that as well. And it may not be that you get these bridges as choke points. We also have, you could do it another way, which we do in many, many cities. We take 20 or so just locations that are centered near activities. So it might be schools, it might be a shopping area, it might be a community center, it might be downtown, it might be, you know, other employment areas which could be out in suburban or whatever. So you just pick areas that make sense from a land use and transportation perspective and count those. And it's not so much what you count as long as you count consistently over time so you can get a trend line. It's never, you can't just do one count 1 year. You have to do a trend line over time. And we've been, through my company, spearheading a national effort to get cities all across the U.S. to collect this data. Traffic models are based on data. They're based on past performance. We've got 100 years of car-oriented data that's allowed us to build up these traffic models that show that whatever you do, whatever you build, there's going to be more traffic. And that dictates for cities that you have to put in more lanes and more time for left turns and more bigger everything for cars. And we don't have 100 years of data to prove that, well, if you do something different, instead if you trade off space from motor vehicles and shift it over to biking, or you put in key trails, or you do an encouragement program, that you can change that paradigm and your traffic model should adjust to that. We don't have the data that allows us to get to that level of sophistication in most places. So our effort to collect data is, it sounds really geeky, but it's super critical. And so every city I go to, one of my core, I do about 12 or so keys, depending on the community, that are relevant to their community. And one of them is almost always document what you're doing, document your progress, do the counts, and write them in a report every year and put them into this national database and document your progress, because we absolutely need that information from a traffic modeling standpoint.
Let's talk about the business. You turned, as the book chronicles your career, you go from a bicycle advocate in the city of Portland. Now you've got your own firm here. It's quite a transition. What is Alta Planning all about?
It's about creating active communities where bicycling and walking are safe, normal, healthy, and fun daily activities. And the growth of Alta sort of is another variation on the same trajectory of hearts and minds being opened to bicycle transportation. And it comes out of, I was at the city of Portland from 1983 to 1999, working in the bike program. But in 1999, I left the city to be a mom for a while. And when I had my first child, and I was at home thinking about what I wanted to do next, and I got a call from this guy in California, Michael Jones, who had this little two-person consulting firm focused on bicycling and walking, and did I want to open a Portland office for him? And I thought, you know, work out of my house part-time with the new baby, on doing exactly what I love to do? Yeah, like twist my arm, right? How could I say no to this? I actually flew down to California to kind of check it out. Like, is this guy for real? I had met him before, but he was fantastic at public engagement and really understood what to do. And so he had landed this big federal contract to study trails on active railway lines. So, you know, everybody knows about rails to trails, where you take an abandoned railway line and convert it to a trail. Rails to Trails Conservancy. The next wave, well, they started to run out of those conversions of abandoned railway lines, and the rail industry started to resurge. And so then there was lots of trail advocates all around the country that are looking at rail lines in cities, and they're seeing flat, wide, scenic locations and going, ooh, that's where we want a trail. And they were going to the railroads and saying, hey, do you mind if we just slap a trail down here on your private property? And the railroads were saying, no, no way. It's another variation on kind of all this resistance. And
you do a nice job in the book talking about that too. Some of the like resistance to change, dealing with putting bicycles on the bridge and on alongside the railroad tracks too. It's fun to read that too. Once you get past it, right? Once you get to success.
Well, it was fun living it. I have to say that I can tell you my top favorite things I've done in my career. The Portland Bike Master Plan, both the first one and the update that we just finished last year, which I love it, just because I live in Portland. So I love being able to see what we've done here and experiencing it every day. Second is this study, this Rails with Trails Lessons Learned, because for 4 years, then I lived and breathed the issues between the railroads and their opposition and their concerns and their real day-to-day life and the trail advocates and their truly heartfelt desire to put in trails. And navigating those two worlds was a joyous experience. It really was. And coming to
It wasn't easy either, though. I mean, you didn't have instant success.
No, and we still are fighting every battle one-on-one. But it was really eye-opening. And it's the net result, of course, right? That the study then was published, and it opened the door to thousands of miles of trails that wouldn't have been built if there hadn't been the federal government basically opening that door, because they were about to ban it at that point. So that was, you know, so that was kind of the start of Alto. We have this couple people in California, and we have me working out of my home. I've got a baby crawling around and jamming stuff into the fax machine, and I'm down into Kinko's every night and jamming their machines and trying to build up a business. You know, I hung up my little shingle on the door, bike consultant for hire, and thinking people are just going to call me. They're just going to pick up the phone and they're just going to call. And it, of course, isn't that way, right? We all know that. So then I had to start marketing, you know, calling everybody in the engineering field and planning field and government agencies and trying to convince them that there's a need to hire a firm that specializes in bicycle transportation and walking and has had the experience working in the city of Portland crafting some of these walking and biking policies and programs. And so then we just started expanding and learning how to run a business. I mean, running a business is nothing I had experience in. So the learning of the business side of things became a passion. I mean, basically took myself back to school and read every business book and joined business groups and took classes and made a lot of mistakes along the way and worked really closely with my partner, Michael Jones. We brought in some other business partners who were real smart, you know, surrounded myself with the real smart people that know more than I did. And we kept expanding. We learned the marketing side of things and the business side of things. And eventually over time, I took more and more of that responsibility. So I took on the finance role and I became the chief financial officer and the chief operating officer. And I did that for a number of years. We went from having, you know, bookkeeper part-time out of a woman's house down in California, who was my partner Michael's nanny, to, you know, moving finance up here, buying this building. We bought another building and renovated it, a warehouse. Then we outgrew that one. We bought this building and renovated it. It's about 10,000 square feet right in the heart of the central city. And then we opened little offices all around the country. So we have about 16 small offices. Yeah, it's really cool. And they're like finding the people. I built up a staff we had to find people that are skilled in this field, which there aren't very many because there's no training programs. There's no university programs that teach this. So again, when I started teaching in 2002, that was one of the only courses of its kind in the country. There was another one in Albany State University that my partner Jeff teaches. Jeff Olson. So he had some students on the East Coast that he employed. And then I started teaching at Portland State, and I instantly realized, man, these young smart people they need to come. They get it, and they need to come work for me. And so I started building up a staff of people that I had essentially trained through Portland State. Portland State's excellent planning program. So there was the foundation that they got through planning, but then what I was able to teach them. And that became the foundation of our young, you know, kind of growing staff. And then since then on, it's been trying to find the right people who have the right skills in the right location at the right time, which is all, that's the core of business, right? Figuring out what risks to take and when to hold back, figuring out how to make sure people pay us because, darn it, the dollars of you got it.
It's gotta work.
Consulting's kind of a stupid business if you look at it from a, you know, a pure business standpoint. You know, you basically spend a ton of money to convince somebody to hire you that works for the government. Their time moves about 10 times slower than like business time, right? The time, the pace is very different. You convince them to hire you, then it takes, you know, a while and you eventually get a contract. Then you do start doing the work. So you're advancing, you're basically loaning them the money the whole way. You're doing the work, you're incurring expenses, then you send them an invoice for the work, and then they take their time in many cases to pay you. So, you know, it took me a full year when I started consulting to get my first check of a project that I had landed and brought in. And so the business side of it has got to be solid or you're going to sink really fast. You got to stay up on all of the accounts receivables and the invoicing and all that stuff and boring stuff, but really, really critical. And that's been really the business story is continuing is we have a very dedicated, extremely passionate group of owners and staff. Everybody's so dedicated to this. And we have also a group of visionaries and dynamic risk takers who are, you know, moving fast. Like we're going to do everything we can do within the lifespan that we've got and we're not going to wait. You know, we're going to, so it's always been a joke within our company that, we're looking at the books one day and we go, we've got a hiring freeze because we can't afford to hire any more people. And the very next day we've got two new offices, you know, that it's a very fast paced environment. And we all had to reconcile ourselves to the notion that this isn't going to be slow growth. This isn't going to be like, you know, follow the business plan, step one, step two, step three, step four. This is going to be crazy. And it is. It's just crazy all the time. But in a good way, you know, challenging. It's never boring. I'll tell you that. Never boring.
As we wrap up, Mia, it sounds like you're building quite a legacy. Did you ever think about that? Take the long distance view backwards and see yourself moving forward, having a big influence in a lot of communities around the country?
You know, I manage a whole bunch of planners, but I'm not really a planner. So it's hard for me to actually envision the future and like that. But I will, it is my absolute greatest honor to be able to influence the world in a positive way and to empower people to live healthier lives and be connected to their community and be able to get around by bike and to transform, to create infrastructure and programs that allow people to make those choices. It's such an honor. It fills my heart with just joy. That's why the book is called Joyride. So for me, it's every person that I influence, every email that I get that says that somebody read the book or heard me speak or is on their bikes now, just, you know, my heart just explodes with joy and gratitude. So the book ends with the word gratitude specifically, because that is how I feel like my career has been. Like, I wanted to write this book in part as a gift to give back to all the people that have helped and all the people that have been part of this revolution. And it's just such an honor to have found a career where I get to help make the world a better place and to have been able to make a living, not just for me, but for all the people that work at Alta, all these amazing young people who are buying houses and having kids and living a good life and having a career where their hearts are fulfilled. You know, their souls feel really fulfilled. I mean, a lot of people have jobs that fill their bellies, but there's not that many people that really get to have a job that truly fulfills their souls. And so that's where I just feel so blessed. And that's what gets me up through every battle that you read about in the book and every challenge that we go through. They're all insignificant compared to the good that I've been able to do.
Thank you very much, Mia. Nice to meet you.
Yeah. Thank you. Nice to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Well, we're back in the studio, and once again, let me say thank you to BikeTiresDirect.com. Well, it's officially summer, huh? And in my neighborhood, I'm seeing more cyclists than I've ever seen before. I'm sure it's because my eye is tuned for that. But I was on the peninsula today here in Newport Beach, California, and there were bicyclists everywhere, and school just got out yesterday. So it's exciting to see. It's a little crowded, it's a little nutty out there, and lots of motorists looking for parking places too. But it's an exciting time, and I enjoy seeing all those cyclists out there. So you too, if it's been a while for you, dust off that bicycle and take yourself a ride. You'll feel like a kid again. That's how I feel. You enjoy today's interview? Why don't you send me a comment? Come to cdmcyclist.com and leave a message for Mia. She'd love to hear your point of view. I know not all of you agree with everything she had to say or this whole bicycle movement, but perhaps you stopped listening a long time ago. But anyway, leave me a comment, please, at cdmcyclist.com. Well, thanks so much for listening. Good night.